It is Saturday, November 11th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KOSP.org. You've heard a lot about the cloud. Today, we talk a bit about what the details, what it is, how it works, and all that kind of thing. It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Michael Rogers, a JavaScript community organizer and director of evangelism at DigitalOcean. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
You can go ahead and get a little closer to the
all
mic.
Right. Morning. Yeah, there we
nice,
go.
Nice. So we'll dive in. We're going to talk a little bit about DigitalOcean, what they provide. Kind of the idea of the details of the cloud is kind of how I'm structuring it. As longtime web developers and stuff, I'm kind of frustrated with the cloud concept, that idea and that name, but it sure has become popular. So we couch it in that, even though we're really going to be talking about virtual private servers. Okay, Miles, you want to give me the newest on Facebook stuff, or is that what you're ready for?
Sure.
Okay.
Facebook wants people to start voting more.
For what? Like U.S. political stuff?
Yes.
Okay, that's good.
Yes. Because, well, young people in general, the technorati, don't vote.
That's sad.
By large. It's,
they tend to like things, but they don't vote.
Right. And so
voting was only like liking.
Yes, exactly. And so what they're going to be doing is making some nice changes to their UI so that that tool will say, like, yes, I voted, and I want you to vote too, and sending it off to their friends, and send it off to their friends, and you start getting your Facebook feed filled up with, like, I voted, have you? You know, that type of thing.
As soon as you say, I voted, do all those things go away so your feed gets cleaned up again? Because then it's compelling. But you're going to get pestered all day on Tuesday is what you're saying.
You know what? I'm okay with people getting pestered.
Because you want people to vote.
Yes, absolutely.
Because you're a noble man.
I was actually thinking along the lines of, let's see, the top 1% of earners, they vote on a rate of like 99%. And the people who are in poverty tend to vote at the level of, say, 30%.
That's maybe not the same.
Right. And then you start looking at people who are over the age of 60 tend to vote at 99%. Mm-hmm. People who are under the age of 30 tend to vote less than that. So if you can get more people to vote, a greater portion of the population, I think you will have more policies that will reflect the wishes of everyone rather than just a few.
Is the problem solely voting or being registered to vote?
The problem is not just being registered to vote, because getting registered to vote has actually become much easier, especially if you're in California and you can register while you get your driver's license type of thing. And there is the issue with college students going, well, I want to still be registered to vote in my hometown, which is, you know.
But then they're not there when voting
only
occurs.
In a lot of cases, like, you know, 4 hours away, which is not very far. They're still in California. But then they go like, but I want an absentee ballot. But then they don't actually follow up with that. And then voting day comes and they can't do anything about it. And
yeah,
it's all.
Yeah. Being in college, you're kind of busy.
Being in college, you're kind of flaky.
Yeah. That's what I was meant. Didn't I say that? So our voting system's like really flawed in the sense of inviting people to participate, right? If it was a UI, no one would use it, right? It's not the best we could do, I think, as a society, but it's what we have. And
let me just say that I think there is merit to people saying, but if you vote, it doesn't necessarily change everything or make everything good. I believe that's true. Just voting is not enough. But it's necessary. It's a necessary first step.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the thing I'm always questioning is why a large corporation like Facebook would do this. What's the motivation?
Well,
is it publicity stunt? Is it actually going to help people use their service more? Because that's their target, right? To get people to use it more. So theoretically, if they tell anybody to do something in the real world, they spend time away from Facebook. Or maybe you're in line at the polls and you're checking Facebook.
Well, as far as Facebook, the organization, is concerned, I can't speak to that. If they're acting any way, any other way that a large company does, whether it be Google or you know, some other large company, it's going to be there's someone there that thought, hey, this is a way that I really want to be active in this zone. I want to do this, and no one got in their way. It didn't hurt the bottom line, and no one got in their way.
Right. Well, and they have obvious political interests, right? And the more that people voting look like people that use Facebook,
that's
the
a good
more
point.
That sure. they have influence over voters, right?
All right. So, and those are, and I don't think those are actually bad reasons to support this. So I like it. I'm glad they're doing it. Okay, here's a question for you guys. Did you know that Facebook recently has a blog post about their development space, talking about the tools and what they do. And they're pushing forward a new project to enable Tor as a service. Now, Tor used to be the Onion router, and it's a way of having anonymity online where everything, all the traffic that goes through Tor is spread out in such a way that's theoretically that you're anonymous.
This is how Chelsea Manning was able to send things to WikiLeaks without still being anonymous. That's why, you know, she didn't get caught from sending them. She got caught because she told somebody about it.
Right, right. So this is a really great feature to have in a society, complete anonymity for things like whistleblowing, of course. And the way Tor traditionally worked is the service that you were contacting was actually a public service. So from your home, you could be in Tor and then access some site. And the site, of course, that you're accessing through Tor knows who you are, especially if you log in. So the question I've got for you guys is, if you're using Tor, this anonymity system, so that your location and your real identity is not known, but then you go to Facebook where you're supposed to have your real identity on Facebook, right? And then you log in, you have your social network on Facebook, they know who you are. So how does this actually help privacy? Nothing. All right, there you go.
I think it helps the perception of privacy, maybe.
But, that was my cynicism, too. Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned this, because I was reading a document on talking about diversity issues, actually, online and tech. And one of them had to do with real name policies and how there were a lot of people saying, like, yes, you want to have this. What's the problem? What's the problem? And the teams that had women in the tech process and in the development of the product had a much more nuanced view on that, going, there's some really good reasons why people don't want to have their real name on there. For no other reason than the abuse that comes with, like, for example, with Gamergate. And yes, I'm bringing it up again.
Well, and also, I remember reading recently that Facebook, you know, kind of doubled down on this real name policy where, there are, I believe, like some burlesque dancers and some other people who have stage names. And they only want their online presence to use their stage name. And they're actually getting kicked off right now.
Right, right. Yeah. And really,
well, that was happening. Yeah, we covered that a few weeks ago.
We did,
and Facebook pulled back and said, sorry. Okay, we still want to have this policy, but you guys, that's stage name is perfectly legitimate. That they were carving out this nice little wedge.
I have a friend who he and his partner have been harassed for years by this person that always used anonymity as the way to harass them. Right, so. Mm-hmm. You know, his personality online is transparent, and he uses his real name. And then this other person that has a beef makes multiple accounts and attacks him. Mm-hmm. And with anonymity, that's easy to do that too, right? So the harassment can be from these anonymous users. Right. So I can see that argument.
And the logical conclusion is that when you put in real name policies, abuse drops.
Right.
Unfortunately, the data shows it doesn't.
Good point. All right.
Well, and even if it did, though, are we that concerned about sort of annoying trollish comments, or are we more concerned about the kind of, you know, death threats and doxing that happen when your real identity is out there? Right.
Right. Right. Because of course, what's happening when you're getting threatened? I mean, when you have an anonymity completely online, and there's a troll, it's not threatening for you.
Right.
Besides your network, of course.
It really comes down to there being a community. And one example I'd like to bring up is Xbox Live. That was like the quintessential, this is a hostile environment for everyone. And for years, like if you went on, you put headphones on, you were listening to the live chats, it was really just epithet after epithet. And what makes me wonder about this and how that was able to come about is because a lot of times it was these 12, 14-year-old boys who were just going all out and just letting loose. Where are the parents that have to be hearing them yelling into their microphone?
Oh, wow. You're a good parent.
These horrible things, and then saying like, oh, well, it's just the game. Who cares what it is? How do you let your kid say that to anyone in any context. Like, that's just that I think is where the failing is, not in a real name policy or.
Yes, I agree. Blame the parents.
Sorry. As a parent, like,
all right. By the way,
there is some culpability that has to be shown there.
I think it really has to do with liability more than anything. I think the reason why they want real names is because if they don't say that they're trying to put people's real names, they can't put the responsibility for their behavior and anything illegal that they do onto them rather than on the institution.
Right. So protects. Yeah, that's a good point. All right, let's talk about Virginia.
Okay, so if you have a phone, it has a passcode on it. Police stop you, and they say, we want to see the contents of that phone. Well, the Supreme Court has said, no, well, wait a second. A phone is something that has all of your personal information on there. It's your diary. It's your schedule book. It's your contact list. This is stuff that we should be protecting. So, and giving a passcode is akin to a Fifth Amendment breach of your volunteering information that could incriminate you. A Virginia judge has said, well, police can, without a warrant, demand that a suspect unlock the phone with their fingerprint. In other words, Apple's Touch ID.
Something they have rather than something they know.
Right.
Just like
except that it's something, it's not like a key, which you were bringing up in
beforehand. Yeah, in the pre-show I was saying that, you know, for years, if you're searching a home and there's a safe and you know where the key is, you can be compelled to give them the key, a physical thing. Right. Even though the knowledge of where the key is, you have to use, and therefore they're kind of using your mind.
Right. Of course, there are limits on that. Like, there has to be exigent circumstances.
That's
like,
right.
There has to be a real need that they have to get in there now and not get the warrant. But that's fine. At the same time, your fingerprint is the key that you can't ever leave at home.
Yeah.
You can't ever put it someplace. You can't ever accidentally, you know, lose it down a storm drain on your, you know, that type of thing. So
you're saying is now that we've got this fingerprinting capability in many devices as the iOS devices become popular, police can unlock your phone, getting access to your entire history of who you are just by compelling you to use a fingerprint. You don't think the court should allow that?
Right.
Yes.
I think there is a disconnect between how the technology is moving along and how the laws are being interpreted by a technology that didn't exist before.
Right. Now, so that means that if you're going to be pulled over or stopped, whatever, power down your phone.
Yeah, because when it comes back up, it requires the actual passcode.
Right.
And then you can't be compelled
now,
for
at the same time, like, we don't want to encourage someone to, you know, don't break the law. Like, you have something that you're doing wrong and you're trying to cover up evidence because that would be bad, and we're not talking about
criminal activity. We're talking about personal rights.
Right.
All right.
Just to make that distinction clear in case anyone wants to get mad at us.
So since we're talking about privacy, let's go into a great article by Cooper Quinton that's on the EFF website. That's the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And it's an organization that supports, and I talk a lot about it on GeekSpeak, talks a lot about rights and civil liberties in the internet age. And so that's the organization that's been helping people when they get sued by large corporations for certain issues. They'll bring up lawyers and support them. So it's a really cool organization. And Cooper Quinton wrote an article and actually really investigated something that Adobe Reader was doing. Are either of you using like Adobe Reader to have like read books? Are you using that? I don't use it.
No. Not on Mac,
yeah.
It's really unnecessary on Mac. So.
Yeah. So, right, because we have Adobe Reader built into OS 10, so it's pretty easy to open PDFs.
Yeah, all my stuff goes up on Google Drive, and then you just have a viewer.
So it became clear recently on this Adobe Reader, e-reader, it's really about digital books, that it was phoning home. It was every time you read a document and you were going through it and read multiple books, it was actually sending information about what pages you read, where your bookmark was, and all this information to Adobe. Though the software didn't actually require that for using the software. It just did that on the side. This is a privacy concern, of course, because you don't want a corporation knowing what you're reading. And it's kind of nasty. In fact, there was a bit of press about it, and the response was to release a version 4.0.1, which encrypts all communication to Adobe through SSL, which is actually partially a good thing because if it's sending information about your privacy over an open wire, non-secure connection, then anyone that's in between could listen to it, and that's not good. But the question was, wait, now they're encrypting that. Are they just hiding that they're still sharing it? So as people were investigating this, they found that in the version that was being bad, it was doing more than just what you were reading with that software. If you connected an e-reader to your computer and that software was running, it looked through the library and sent to Adobe your entire library. So it was really bad.
That was awesome.
Yeah. So what's cool is that Adobe's really fixed it in 0.1. Cooper Quinton, who wrote this article, used an inspection tool to unencrypt the SSL packets and took a look. And sure enough, nothing being sent. And so they've totally repaired this problem. They're not phoning home what you read, which is great. Additionally, they turned off the response completely to version 4.0.0. So where it was sending information, that system is no longer receiving information, which is really cool. So Adobe's doing the right thing, which feels like a lot of the times on the show we don't talk about the companies doing the wrong thing. So
Yeah, and there has to be some notice that many times when companies are doing the wrong thing, sometimes it's just because someone didn't audit back through and think about the privacy implications of what they were doing. Case in point, Apple, with their whole every time you make a search on the new operating system, it sends that information to Apple servers.
Right.
I don't think Apple did that to be creepy or to mess up privacy. I think they were trying to make a feature that with iCloud you have this available everywhere in every device and stuff like that, and you just have this confluence of events. But unfortunately, it ends up you have all of your information going to Apple.
Yeah, not good. So the things to learn about this is that privacy needs to be built in early on. Project managers need to be thinking about it the entire time. Engineers need to think about every time they make a decision on whether something should go forward to a company or be shared or not encrypted. They really should be thinking about privacy and their own privacy.
And we need diverse groups of people on these teams so that we can see it from more than just one particular demographic's viewpoint.
Yeah, good point. Well, you're listening to Geek Speak, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak. Tilly Olson wrote stories that explain the possibilities of 20th century fiction, exploring the experiences of women and working people who literature had mostly ignored. Now, with a republishing of some of her classic out-of-print work, it's time to consider her legacy as a writer and political activist. Tilly's daughter, the writer Jolie Olson Edwards, and granddaughter, the poet Rebecca Edwards, joined the host Robert Pauly to look back at the life and writing of Tilly Olson. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking Persons Radio with Robert Pauly tomorrow at noon on KUSP. You can also, of course, learn about it and get the podcast and all that from the website 7thAvenueProject.com. That's with a 7, the number, because you can do that with domains. Did you guys know that? I'm talking to Michael Rogers and Miles Elam. And Miles, do you have some web extras for us this week?
Yes, we've talked about Gamergate in the past, and we've harped about it, and it's been in the news. And there's still some folks that are going, what is this all about? Best case that I've ever seen was when Anita Sarkeesian, a person who was doxxed fairly recently, was interviewed by Stephen Colbert. And Colbert is always such a wonderful foil. It's really great to have this as an illuminating voice. So we're going to post it up as a web extra on the website after the show.
That's at geekspeak.org. You're listening to GeekSpeak on KUSP and Lyle Troxel with me in the air room. That was Miles Elam and Michael Rogers. Now, Michael is here to talk to us a little bit about his day job. He works at DigitalOcean as an evangelist. This means that you, I'm assuming, kind of support developers using DigitalOcean services, right? Is that kind of what evangelism?
Partially. I mean, what we mainly do is that we sort of live in the developer communities, and we try to give back as much as we can and just like be out there and be with people and understand what people want from the products and from like not just our offerings, and also understand like who is doing amazing work and how do we highlight that and how do we support it.
Yeah. So we've seen an explosion over the last 10, 15 years in virtual private servers and the idea of hosting hardware that supports multiple servers and giving access to people to those servers. First time I put a machine online, it was a box that I built and found some small startup and slid it in there, and I had to run send mail. You know, it was just a nightmare. I had to do all the stuff in the box.
You still have to send mail.
Yeah. So the idea with the when we talk about the cloud, what we're really talking about services that allow you to put computing not in your own space, but kind of virtualized and everywhere. And this allows some really wonderful things to happen. When you virtualize the service that you're dealing with as a developer, you're releasing a product on a machine, and then there's some company that's taking care and making sure that that is replicated, that if power goes out in San Francisco, your service is still up because there's actually copies all over the planet. So some things that can happen that are this really
distribution as well. Yeah.
It's a really complicated thing to describe to the general population. Mm-hmm. So instead of talking about like all of those feature sets, what we're going to do is talk a little bit about what DigitalOcean offers as VPS, virtual private servers, mm-hmm. Which is the primary service that you provide, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So and then competitors to this space, Rackspace is a major one, right?
Yeah. Although, I mean, the really the only one that you need to talk about is Amazon.
Because Amazon's massive, right?
Right. So yeah. Amazon is the number one cloud provider, like, in the world now. And also, I think that, you know, it's not a stretch to say that Amazon has gone after the end developer market, and that's definitely where we are as well.
The end developer. You want individual developers, startups.
Individual developers, people that put up a server or two, right? Like, this is a, you know, it doesn't sound, you know, as cool as, you know, a giant enterprise company that's spending $100,000 a month. And when you talk to most cloud companies, their salespeople are like, oh, God, I got to
get these, one of those clients.
I got to get these $100,000 a month clients. But the reality is that the developer market, you know, they're doubling every 2 years. It's huge. Yeah. And so that's where our focus is. And that's definitely where Amazon's focus has been as well.
So let me get some disclosure. I work at Netflix, and Netflix's services run after December will be 100% on Amazon. And Netflix's data transfer in the U.S. is 1/3 the internet. So that's the kind of size that Amazon is.
So it's massive, right? When Netflix is your customer.
Yeah, exactly. That's impressive stuff. Now, let's get a little closer to the microphone. I think we need to. All right. So what you're providing when you talk about in developers, and that's another thing to note. I actually, quite a while ago, before you were working for DigitalOcean, I think, I wanted to get GeekSpeak a little more reliable as a server, and I was doing some kind of free share thing, and I finally spun up a DigitalOcean, what do you call them? Droplets, right?
Yeah.
Which is a server. So the GeekSpeak website actually runs on one of those. And then when my kids wanted to play Minecraft all the time, I beefed that up to a little larger space, and I'm running a Minecraft server for them. So these are the kind of things you can do on a virtual server, right? I don't deal with the hard drive. In fact, there's probably not really a hard drive, per se, on the box that I'm using. It's like distributed magic?
There's a hard drive somewhere, but that's getting split up over a bunch of different customers, right?
Right.
And this is really important for end developers, right? Like, you don't want to have to pay a couple $100 a month for a dedicated hardware.
Right.
Usually what you want to do is you want to pay $5 and spin up a little service and, you know, run Minecraft or whatever on it. And especially when you're talking about, you know, like, I have a weekend project where I want to play around and I just want to spin it up and put it up somewhere and not care about it anymore. You want it to be really cheap and you want it to be, like, you know, as reliable as possible. You know, maybe not, you know, multiple regions going out reliable, but, you know, reliable in that, you know, it's not, the performance isn't just going to fall through the floor.
Right. And it's not in your closet making noise.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we really talk about the difference. If Amazon's looking for these major companies that are doing hundreds of thousands of dollars per month and you are focusing on the end developer, is that long tail actually going to work as a long solution?
Well, I mean, I joined the company in March, and we were the seventh largest provider in the world at that time.
So you're not small.
Up from zero in 2 years, right?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Today we're number four, so not that long.
That's pretty good. So that's all because of you.
it's entirely me. No, that's not true at all, actually. We've just done a really good job. I mean, we turned it into a real product. Like, when you use, you know, end users have gotten very used to a lot of usability in their products, right? Like, everything is easier to use today than it was, you know, 2-3 years ago.
Right.
When I open up my phone, everything works better.
Except for microwaves. They're still more complicated than they need to be.
Okay. Right. Well, everything on the internet.
Okay, thank you.
And this has become an expectation of end users, but not so much developers and developer tooling. Like, when you go and you use a lot of services that are written for developers, you know, there's a huge section of the developer market that has a high threshold for complexity. And so you can force and you can force some of that complexity onto your users and not lose them. Right. But what you are losing is these potential people that would come that really didn't care. Right. I mean, yeah. The last startup that I had that I was like a co-founder of, at least, we were on SoftLayer. And SoftLayer has this giant kind of control panel. And I mean, it might be much better today. So don't right. you know, I'm not
dogging them. You're talking about the complexity.
Right. But the interface to use SoftLayer and to manage the server was, it could have been written in 1999. It really could have been. I mean, it was, you know, tables and very tiny text everywhere. And like every detail about the technology was sort of pushed to me and forced on me.
Mm-hmm.
And like when you use our product and you know, even Amazon's getting better with their stuff. But especially with us, you know, you hit a button and you get server.
Yeah.
And that server already has your key on it and everything is great.
So let's talk a little bit about the details, because of course a lot of people that aren't developing don't understand the kind of concept of it.
Right.
You go buy a new computer and you have a piece of hardware and you open it up and it has a few steps to say, who are you? Let's set up your username and password. There's a step process. Apple does these annoying videos that you can't turn off, but you know, whatever, it's a new machine, so you're excited for a little while. And so you go through this process. At the end of that, you kind of own that machine. That's a physical machine, of course. In a virtual server environment, you have the same kind of setup time. You need to set something up. Something needs to start working for you so you have access to it. And the cloud providers are basically saying, create a new instance of a server, and it's like a few steps, but then it's up. And that means that you've got a dedicated computer somewhere that always has internet, that you don't worry about power, you don't worry about the network to it, and you pay a little month for that service. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about VPS. And the complexity system you're talking about, Amazon, of course, is providing so many different features. They have storage, they have... instead of just servers, they also have processor banks, like you can actually run application code, not that you really have a whole service, you more have a space for your application to run. And all these kind of features, of course, comes with different levels of complexity. So as long as you know, what I've found is as long as you know what you're looking for on Amazon, you can actually spin up a server pretty easily. But I never know the names because they have all these complicated names for all the different services they have.
Yeah, there's also the efficiency aspect to it and power consumption. Mm-hmm. For the most part, when we had the GeekSpeak server and we were dealing with our own hardware, there was a large portion of the time where that machine did not have its CPU maxed out.
Right. But its fans were still running.
Yes.
And it was a server, so you had to have the hard drive run.
Yeah. You know, was seeking and getting stuff, but it really wasn't pushing very hard.
Mostly what it was doing is heating up the closet and annoying the family.
But, I mean, it was fun having that hardware, but at the same time, it's if everyone does that, you have, you know, huge numbers of people that are using 15% of the capacity of a server. And 85% is just wasted heat that's just not being used.
Yeah.
And when you have a setup like AWS or you have DigitalOcean, then you're able to actually parcel out these boxes and, you know, max them out or get them to 85%.
And this matters a lot for the end consumer because the more that you can get out of that hardware, the less you're going to pay
right,
for the service.
Right.
And it also has to do with the power grid. The data centers are a non-trivial amount of the power that's being used now, electricity that's being used by the U.S. and around the world. So,
you know, I'm curious, Michael, because you said that you've kind of focused the goal to make it an enjoyable experience, if you will, like a good user interface for developers, and that sometimes a developer is not thought of as needing that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I think as Miles and I have grown up aging and having kids and stuff, we have less... I mean, I personally, I don't want to talk to you. I speak for you, but I have less desire to really figure something out and spend time to make that work and like kind of the pain of that. It used to be a game for me and I'd enjoy it. I mean, I think that's why we're all, you know, geekies. We got into that.
We all have Macs, right?
Right.
We don't have these like Linux machines where we're recompiling the kernel every other weekend.
Exactly.
Like when you were younger.
And I've got an iPhone and I don't crack it, right? Like it's just, it is what it is and it's as good as it is and I don't have to spend time on it. And so to me, it feels like the development community might be growing to the stage where they don't want to do those little tweaks. They just want it to work just like it works when you make a phone call.
Well, you were saying you didn't want to speak for me. For me, I do want to do all these things. I just don't have time.
No, you don't make time.
No, I really don't have time.
You could quit your job. Then you wouldn't have the pretty toys.
But you want to know that you can because it's part of your identity.
I like tweaking with my Mac and doing development. I mean, you are tweaking with stuff. It's just, I mean, I don't know.
Have you used Slate? Slate's a window manager for macOS 10,
no.
Which you know about this, Michael?
Yeah.
So you code it all through a JavaScript, the entire thing, and it's like really fun. And I spent way too much time on that for like a week, and was like, "What am I doing?" So
I was actually tripped up by the fact that macOS, instead of using AppleScript for scripting things, you can now do it in JavaScript.
Yes,
that's really cool.
Have any of you done this?
It's all complete now. Mm-hmm. You have a node instance running on your Mac, so that connects up with with what was AppleScript to talk to that information that goes back to your node, and then that serves a page, which then also runs JavaScript to do dynamism on your on the front end.
I have to say that it's very exciting to me because every time I've gone into, I go, I should just solve this problem to script this little thing I need to do, right? And I go into AppleScript and I spend about a half an hour to maybe 45 minutes, and then I go, I hate this language with a passion. It's wrong in every way.
Really?
I don't like AppleScript.
I like it for what it is, but it's not what we're used to.
Yes. No, it's really because I spend 15 to 20 minutes, 45 minutes every year and a half. Like, that does not denote expertise.
Right.
But, you know, every time I see a new, like, you know, AppleScript book, I definitely grab it and put it on my shelf and I don't read it.
Yeah. But I don't think that it's just the existing developer community aging. I think, you know, I spent a lot of time kind of studying growth, particularly growth of open source ecosystems and languages. Mm-hmm. And where you get the vast majority of growth, if you're growing a lot, it's basically in brand new people, in amateurization, basically. Mm-hmm. People who would not have been able to do what they're doing now if this thing hadn't come around.
Right.
You know, the biggest example of this was the web, right? Like, the web isn't successful because people with PhDs in computer science make websites. It's very popular because, you know, 10-year-olds make websites. And because, you know, people with humanities degrees went into startups and just started, you know, doing stuff. I mean, high school dropouts.
And 14-year-olds co-found the first iteration of Firefox.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, and what you're saying is it's that remove the barriers for getting your own server, that kind of ease of use allows more people to do it. Right?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, once you have that server, you know, a lot of the tooling on it is a bit easier to use. You know, if you were going to go and write a server or a service, now you have like Node.js and you have like, you know, all of this amazing ecosystem that makes it really, really easy to even put stuff on that server.
Yeah.
So there are people that want to have a server that don't want to invest in all the complexity of getting that thing up and trying to understand all this stuff that we know because we've been doing it for 10 years, but they don't want to learn.
Well, it's also a question of where the complexity is.
Right.
Like, the systems are so much more complex than they were 15 years ago, than definitely what they were 30 years ago. I mean, that was just a different world.
Right, but how do we not show that to the end developers that just want to put something up and make a product?
Right, and that comes down to componentization and encapsulation, so that people are still dealing with a tremendous amount of complexity. They're just dealing with it in their space that, you know, they're not dealing with that. Before, sorry, let me make it more clear. When we were recompiling all of our kernels, we were all good at recompiling our kernels. We were all good at editing text files in ETC. We were all good at doing these things, but we didn't have as much time to work on the periphery outside of there. As you make that more solid and make that foundation solid and a no-brainer, mm-hmm. you have more time for people to concentrate on the complexity at the edges, and that's mm-hmm. where you have that proliferation, and that's where
One clarity I want to give everybody is that when we're talking about spinning up virtual private servers and, you know, really easily having a machine, if you're not a developer, this isn't a useful thing for you, in the sense that you have to start kind of owning the I'm a developer. I'm going to take an application that maybe you grabbed from somewhere else. You might have downloaded the entire thing. You might not have written a line of code, but you do have to have a whole process. We're not talking about, you know, having a website already working for you, right? There's steps involved in these. But anytime you reduce the complexity of any of those steps, you invite more people to participate, right? I had a nephew of mine call me yesterday, and he wants to put up a website, and he just had this simple question of, how do I not make it WordPress.com? And I realized, like, wow, he needs like a day with me just to explain what host domains are and stuff, right? But once he gets that concept, like some of those concepts, he's really much closer to being able to spin up his own website and run Node.js or something.
And to push it even further, you know, like, I mean, a lot of what we do in sort of the evangelism and the community side is that we write tutorials that are made for people that just don't understand all of this stuff so that they can set up a WordPress or they can set up these other services. And then we also have, you know, these one-click images where it's like, oh, here's a server with WordPress already on it. You don't have to install it. It's that kind
of
stuff.
Right. So you do offer those kind of features.
Yeah. I mean, we're really trying to push more of the amateurization and more people and bring more people into the community. And you know, there are lots of people that are, you know, web developers that, you know, don't want to be back-end developers, that don't want to be server administrators, that have to do this for, you know, an hour to get everything set up, and they don't have a lot of great resources for them educationally. So we work on that as well.
You're listening to Geek Speak. That's Michael Rogers. Also with me is Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and we're talking with Michael Rogers and Miles Elam. Miles, you've got a quick thing about Apple Pay. This is one of the news stories we didn't want to miss today.
Right. There is a competing standard that folks like CVS and Rite Aid, or companies like CVS and Rite Aid, are moving to, which is called Current-C. Thing is, though, it's not going to be ready until 2016, I believe.
But I want it now.
Right. But the thing that's really interesting is that many of these places have NFC terminals, near-field communication, and they've been specifically turning them off so that Apple Pay can't work.
Is that because they want to slow down the growth of Apple Pay so that Apple Pay doesn't become a large? I mean, what's the purpose?
As it turns out, many of these companies signed a contract to go with Current-C before Apple Pay was announced.
No.
And so they want to go that route. But there's also a financial incentive behind it, which is Current-C takes that information, ties it directly to a user's bank account,
yep.
and they get the information like, here's the user, and this is their buying habits and stuff like that. Apple Pay completely isolates the vendor from all of that information,
right.
and Google Wallet does the same thing where you put in a PIN on the phone.
What you're saying is when you pay through these new types of forms, Apple Pay and Google Pay, when you pay that
or
way,
Google Wallet, yeah.
Google Wallet, there's no way to say you came back again. You're completely a one-time thing. You're no
right.
tracking
it's
capabilities.
The, yeah. the vendor never sees credit card information. They never see any of that. All they see is a one-time
yep.
pad that goes through. The credit card company or whatever the pay vendor is says, yep, that's valid, comes back. You know, the vendor gets their money and you go on your way and no one knows anything else about
it. So here's what we do. At these places that they turned off the service that I was using before when I had my Nexus 5, right? Because Google mm-hmm. Pay has been around for a while with NFC. Just go there.
Google
bring,
Wallet. Thank
sorry,
you.
Google Wallet. Whatever. Who cares? I'm sorry. Google Wallet. Full disclosure. Miles works for Google. All right. So just take, like, if you're going to buy something there, grab something extra and put it on the counter. And then when they say they don't have that service, just push it away. Okay, I won't buy as much. And maybe that'll filter up. Not that
well.
All right.
Well, that's the thing, though. These companies are now contractually obligated to do this.
Right.
This is starting to sound like Blu-ray HD DVD.
It does. Yeah, totally. And, of course, the best technology will not necessarily win. Thank you, Betamax. We miss you. So, last week's show, I covered a little story about... Is that good, Miles? You summed up that one?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, good. Or you're not. You're hating it. Last week, I talked about how TwitPic, this image service that's been around with Twitter for a long, long time, was going away, and all their images were going to be destroyed and lost, and it was really sad. And people from archive.org were trying to capture all those images to make sure we didn't lose the social culture of those images. The show, if you want to hear more detail about that, is called Tesla's High Pressure Ads Fall from Space. And the only reason you don't understand that title is if you go listen to the show. But any case, TwitPic figured out a way to make a relationship with Twitter, and those images are going to stay up, and Twitter's going to host it. The service will not add new images, but it looks like it'll be there for as long as Twitter is around, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and speaking of archive.org, also, aka the Wayback Machine.
Yeah.
Archive.org. Go there, enjoy it, and if you...
Give them money.
Yes, give them money, because they are a wonderful 501c3 nonprofit that is doing a wonderful service for the web.
Hey, KOSP is a nonprofit like that, too.
Yep.
That's cool.
And you should donate to them, too.
All right. So we were talking with Michael about his job of helping developers get online at DigitalOcean with spinning up services, but now we're going to switch over to another thing of Michael's passion, which is a JavaScript community organizer. And I love, by the way, that you use community organizer on your personal website, because isn't that what, like, Obama was attacked for? You know, he was community organizer.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Concerningly, what Jesus was attacked for, too.
right.
But Michael doesn't have hair, so he's not Jesus. So let's move on. So
wait, what color are your
let's
eyes?
Let's consult a historical record.
So Michael is a developer, and Michael, you actually, the way I know of you is because of your organization of NodeConf and the Node community. When you moved to Oakland and started kind of being a core feature of how Node works, I mean, how the community works. You were at a really great conference that I kind of fell in love with and brought my family the second time up because it was so great, in just the way that you include people.
Right.
And so, and you had a wonderful blog post yesterday that I'll link to talking about, I mean, did you write it yesterday? I don't know.
I published it yesterday.
Yeah, an article talking a bit about making a safe environment for a community, which is actually can sometimes horribly fail in technical industry. There's been like I kind of rode the ride of Ruby growth, and at one point the community started kind of being a nasty space for a short period of time. It's gotten a lot better, I think. Mm-hmm. But the Node community hasn't had that, and it's in a lot of ways because I think of people like you making sure the environment is positive. How do you do that as a tech community grows?
Well, I mean, we were very specific about wanting that, right? Like in the very early days, me and Isaac were talking about this.
Isaac, of course, the person
Isaac Schluter, yeah. He created NPM, which is the major package manager. He was the former project lead.
Which isn't an acronym for Node Package Manager, no matter how many times you say this.
It's a package manager that grew up at the same time as Node.
Right, exactly. But anyway.
But it's not Node Package Manager.
Why is this? Why is it not Node Package Manager? Is it because Node is trademarked?
No, I think that he just likes messing with everybody.
Okay,
to be honest.
I'll go with that.
I don't think that it actually has a real reason. And he likes making up new things that it could mean.
Yes,
right?
Every time you ask him, he comes up with a new one.
Right. There's a list of
because
like
the best way to get people involved is to make sure they have no idea what's going on.
No,
it's to give them a way to contribute, and you can contribute right. by coming up with a new thing that NPM means.
Okay, so Isaac was running the Node project when he was working at Joyent, right? And you were involved with him, and you guys sat down and started talking.
This is even, I mean, if you go back a long ways, it's actually even earlier than that. It's when Isaac was at Yahoo, and Ryan had just sort of announced it and created it, and Ryan was just joining Joyent. Ryan didn't have a huge passion for community organizing, but mm-hmm. he did want it to be a good community, and he wanted that burden and that momentum not to be tied up in him or in Core or Join or anything like that.
Ryan was a student. He grabbed the Chrome JavaScript engine and called V8, and he decided to make a service system out of it. And that he wrote it and then kind of displayed it and kind of showed people. Right. And that is what we know of as Node at this point. Yep. But you're saying that he didn't want to be a core leader person in that in that group.
Well, yeah. I mean, he wanted to focus on the problems that he was interested in solving, and he didn't want to be a blocker for anybody else that wanted to do anything, right? This is why, the package manager is not, is a separate project from Core. This is why Core is relatively small and there's not a giant standard library, right? This is why I run the conference and, Joyent doesn't, because I stepped up to do it. And that perpetuated in the rest of the community, where if you wanted to take over in leadership and take responsibility for something, you would own that. and you could really drive it. And so that in the really early days, we were a bunch of nice people. We wanted to keep it nice. So we were like, okay, let's keep it nice. Let's just keep it civil. One of the big things is that, we didn't want to go out there and write blog posts or do talks where we would attack people or be really negative or say, this thing sucks or that thing sucks. Because maybe you'll get some new users, but you're also going to attract the kind of people that don't mind it when you're up being kind
when
of
you're
a
nasty,
bully, right?
Yeah.
And so by not attracting them, especially in the early days, you start to create a culture where that's just not acceptable. And then when you're accepting enough, and when women and other underrepresented groups start to show up and show leadership, they can take over that ownership. They can really be a leader. There's not a bunch of other people blocking them or institutions blocking them or, in any kind of bureaucracy. And then you just sort of enable those people and they continue to perpetuate this culture that just, stays really nice and accepting.
So you figured this out early? You and Isaac talk about this early?
I mean, we didn't figure it all out early. Yeah. I mean, we made it a priority early, and we continued to iterate on it and talk about it. And I mean, in this article that I wrote about codes of conduct, the code of conduct is it's been accepted pretty widely in JavaScript conferences. Not so widely in other communities, as I'm finding out.
The idea is if you're having an event and you, before the event happens, you publish this conduct and you say, look, everyone's going to abide by these rule sets.
Yeah, it basically just says, don't harass people. Don't be mean. You'll probably get kicked out. That's essentially what it says. And I didn't need that to kick people out. I kicked people out before that, actually. You can enforce civil human behavior without a code of conduct. The real thing that it does is the message of that to other people. And that was the part about it that I didn't quite get at first. And I was wrong about it, and then I accepted it. And now, all of the JavaScript conferences, just in Node, really have taken codes of conduct. And in fact, at DigitalOcean, we instituted a policy a few months ago where we won't sponsor an event or be involved in an event that doesn't have a code of conduct.
Okay, so as a company that you work for?
Yes,
you supported that, yeah.
The amazing thing about that is that some didn't, and we sort of talked to them about it, and it was an educational experience for them, and they adopted one, and they're really excited.
And here's the narrative that kind of hit in your story is that mm-hmm. someone came up to you who basically polled some people, and they said, look, if I see there's a code of conduct at a conference before I go, I know that I'll have support there in case it's a bad experience for me. If there's anything going on, there's a structure, there's somebody thinking about that's organizing that will support a safe environment. And without knowing that, I just don't know what it's going to be like. It could be nasty there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of the resistance that you get and the resistance that I had was that we had a really nice and inviting culture, and I didn't want this to be a conference policy. I wanted it to be this is the Node culture. But new people don't know that. They don't know the existing culture. They need something spelled out that says, this is the kind of behavior that's acceptable and not acceptable.
Yeah, it's really interesting. At Netflix, there's a very specific idea that everybody's independent and can do anything they want. A lot of freedom and responsibility. It's kind of a fundamental core of the company. So, and I'm always finding okay, but people are not always wonderful, right? I mean, the reason why there's not a lot, one of the reasons why there's not a lot of women, there's not an equal majority of women in the tech industry is that it hasn't been an inviting space. Not because
one
people,
of the reasons, yeah.
right. Not because it was planned to be that way, but because people are comfortable with what they're used to, right? So it's just a momentum, it's inertia. And so without really fighting that with some kind of policy, without making some statement, really thinking about it, it's hard to break inertia. So it's the same similar type of thing where you have to kind of say out, yeah, this is what I believe in. So that other people are aware of it and you share it and change what could be something bad. Well, I think it's great you've done that. I feel like we haven't done justice to Node because, of course, a lot of the audience doesn't know what it is. We could talk a little bit about that. We go on to news stories. Node.js, first off, DigitalOcean does more VPS than just Node, right? You don't always spin up Node instances?
Well, I mean, we spin up a server that you can run anything on, literally anything.
Okay.
We have numbers. We know what our customers are using.
Can you share how many percentage Node is?
I don't know it that accurately.
Yeah, okay.
But, we know kind of what's growing, and Node is definitely growing. PHP has a huge renaissance right now. PHP is growing like crazy.
Well, I took a long step away from PHP, and then I went and looked at it again, and it's like better. I mean, in the sense that the community that's producing code, it's better code.
Yeah, well, so this dude, Sendak, he wrote this thing called Composer, which is basically NPM for PHP.
And, oh, really?
And you see that, like, the moment that sort of, like, starts to take off is the moment where PHP has this giant resurgence and people are publishing modules and everything is getting cleaner.
Is there a large community of, like, require type patterns inside
now
PHP?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, if you look at just growth as a percentage of the ecosystem, they're number two right now, probably.
And I would say that it's probably easier to get a server with PHP on it than with Node, right? Because PHP has been around a long time, and it's normally packaged in with any kind of web server that you spin up.
It's harder to compile or install and configure, but it's easier to find something that already has it up. So, yes, yes.
Right.
Well, it's nice to know that fractal of bad design has such a good community around it now.
What do you mean?
PHP.
There's
a blog article saying a fractal of bad design. It was saying that every language has its issues. There is no language that is perfect. There is no environment. There is no library that is perfect. Everything has its warts. Even my favorite languages have their issues, and my least favorite have their versions.
Java has issues, Miles?
Yes.
Sorry.
And who said Java was my favorite?
I just assumed.
Yeah. Anyway, but PHP has this aspect to it that is every time you see some weirdness to it, if you want to write about that and you dig a little bit deeper about what's weird about it, you find all these other weird things that are underpinning the weird thing.
Michael, is this the kind of thing you didn't do early on in the Node community? You didn't like attack the languages? Is that what you didn't do?
Well, I think when I see other ecosystems, what I try to do is I go like, what are they doing right? And PHP is, by any measurement that I know of, the most widely adopted language on the web for backend.
For backend,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, JavaScript, obviously, in the front end, because there's nothing else. on the backend, I mean, one of the reasons why it was so widely adopted is that it is still easier to write a simple simple website that reads from a database, right?
Yeah, it is easier to do in PHP. Yep.
Right, it's easier to do in PHP than any other, even the Node, right? And we've worked so hard to make Node so easy for new people, but it's still not as easy for that use case, right?
You know, PHP.net, the documentation how to use PHP, I think it's PHP.net, that site is like a major reason why I stayed with the language for so long. Mm-hmm. Like anytime I needed a problem answered, it was there, right? It was there was always comments about how you use this feature and the response, and it had a base community space, right? I didn't know anybody there, but it was an easy way to get information. Why is Node not that easy?
The problem's a little different, right? Like we have a pretty extensive API documentation, but Node, what ships with Node, the binary is not very large, right? It's not actually what you use when you even write a website, right? Like you download
use Express
that,
on top of that,
right?
Right,
you make a decision about what you're going to use, like Express or Happy or whatever, I actually do use a core, like a library that wrote called Response sometimes, but
I've used Response. That's yours?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
I wrote request and response.
Yeah.
It's great. There's all these decisions to make right after that, right? And a lot of these small modules do have good documentation and readmes. Some of them don't have good documentation and readmes. But what's really missing is when I take all of these modules and put them together, how do I use them together? What are some really nice patterns around that?
Right. And PHP can think of like the default install already has all those things installed, right? It's already got MySQL driver in it because that's just, it's in there.
Exactly. Yeah. So using this feature has a section using this feature with MySQL, right?
Right.
Because that's just what you do. Python has a giant standard library as well. And I think Node is very, very young, right?
Yeah.
So this is a great problem to have. I mean, our problem is that we have more modules than any other modern any other open source ecosystem ever.
Right.
So we have all of these things that you can use, but that's a decision to make and a lot of sort of documentation about that. But people are working on this problem.
Yeah, why aren't we seeing more bootstraps for Node services, right? Where we're everything's wrapped up and now you've got a basic package. I don't know. It's hard to say because, of course, you need different things all the time, right?
There's a couple, but they've been sort of relegated to the enterprise because, they want to make a decision for a team and then have that team keep with that. I think that there's something very if you're like a creative person and you really want to build something, there's something that hampers your creative spirit when you go, I made all the decisions for you. Like,
yeah.
Like, yeah, no, don't think about this. Don't do things your way. Do them all my way. It makes it less fun,
yeah.
Basically. But I know that NPM is working on this problem, like having collections of things and talking about how they work together. So.
And it's young, as you said, so we'll see how it grows. Michael Rogers is a community organizer in the JavaScript community around Node. He runs the premier conference about Node in the U.S. called NodeConf, which is a wonderful event. And also this wonderful conference called JS Fest, which is happening in Oakland December 7th through the 13th of this year. And JS Fest is a whole bunch of, well, you're just the person that gets it knitted, right? And everybody else is doing it.
I run a couple of them and yeah. sort of keep everybody together.
So if you like JavaScript or development in general, JS Fest is a blast because it's a whole bunch of different venues with different topics, and you can focus all on robotics or you can focus all on something else. And so I'm looking forward to being there on 7th of December, and thanks for organizing it. Michael, thank you so much for being here on GeekSpeak today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. And Michael, of course, also works at DigitalOcean, VPS service provider, along with lots of other ones. Thank you. Yeah. Miles, Elon, also thank you for being here. Let me see if I can get
always a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Hey, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. He's used with permission. And GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can reuse your stuff any way you like. Just let them know we sent you. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast at 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz. Live online at kosp.org. To find out more about this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and Miles and Michael, thank you so much. Thank you for being part of the November 1st show of GeekSpeak. Until next time.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, actor Daniel Radcliffe explains why he hasn't used his magical powers to stop Ebola. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, don't tell me. 1 hour from now on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org, followed at 1 o'clock by 2 hours of traditional and contemporary Celtic music on Continental Drift with Cindy Odom. KUSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, providing high-speed broadband, co-working, and co-location services to Santa Cruz County for 25 years. More information at cruiseio.com or 459-6301. And by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT data protection, storage, and maintenance for business and home computers for over 10 years. More information at hasbtech.com. The time is 11 o'clock. This is Public Radio for the Central.